evening. We're delighted to welcome Mount Horeb High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Program is cleverly entitled Court with Class. We invite students to come and listen to an oral argument. And if they do agree to come, they're given materials about the case and meet at noon after the second case with a justice assigned for that day to meet with the students. The discussion at that session will be about the procedures of the court in taking cases, hearing cases, deciding cases, writing opinions, and mandating opinions. The discussion is not on the substantive issues of the cases we are hearing today. Does anyone want a summary of the case we're going to hear? If you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Okay, we all have full knowledge. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with the students after the second case this morning. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And to his right, Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, which is 2012 AP 55, State versus Andres Romero Gorgana. And arguing on behalf of the defendant is Sarah Kelton. Is it Braley? Braley. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, very little remains in dispute in this case. We know that Mr. Romero was not warned by the trial court of the required warnings of the possible immigration consequences of his plea at his plea hearing. We know that shortly after Mr. Romero was convicted, removal proceedings were initiated against him. And we know that he was eventually ordered removed from this country based on his conviction in this case. Therefore, we know that if post-conviction counsel had raised plea withdrawal under 97108(2) on Mr. Romero's behalf in his first post-conviction motion, he almost certainly would have been allowed to withdraw his plea. We also know that Mr. Romero made the following allegations regarding post-conviction counsel's failure to raise plea withdrawal on his behalf. First, he alleged that he did not understand the possible immigration consequences of his plea before he pled. Second, he alleged that he would not have pled and instead would have gone to trial if he had understood the immigration consequences of his plea. Finally, he alleged that post-conviction counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the plea withdrawal claim on his behalf.
Counsel, what effect, if any, does the plea waiver of rights form that was written in Spanish and for which he had assistance of counsel as well as assistance of an interpreter have, which in which he acknowledged that he understood that his plea could result in deportation?
Your Honor, in State v. Hoppe, this court found that that a plea waiver questionnaire is not a replacement for a plea colloquy. At the colloquy, a reference was made to the plea questionnaire, but we don't know anything really about to what extent, other than what Mr. Romero says in his motion, to what extent the attorney went over the plea questionnaire with him. In his motion, he does state that his attorney just gave him the plea questionnaire and asked him to fill it out and sign it. He also talks about problems with interpreters with his attorney. So nothing in the plea hearing or really anywhere else in the record suggests that just because he signed the form meant that he actually understood.
Well, the form shows that he's had 6 years of formal education and 3 years in technical school from which he got a certificate. So is it your position that he doesn't read Spanish?
No, that's not my position. My position is that sometimes people do sign things without reading it very carefully or without understanding. Also, people have different levels of reading comprehension, even if he does understand to some degree what was in the form.
Did he have any obligation when the trial court mentioned that it was in receipt of this particular form during the colloquy to say, well, yeah, I signed it, but I didn't understand it, or to make some reference disavowing what was in here?
Your Honor, he answered the questions that he was asked at his plea hearing, and I think, and in general, defendants at plea hearings are probably focused on the plea and sort of the immediate aftermath of that. I don't know of any affirmative requirement that he bring up himself. And he was never asked, for example, whether he was satisfied with his, I know I've seen plea hearing transcripts where defendants are asked, you know, are you satisfied with your representation and that sort of question, and nothing like that was asked of him.
So in response to my question, which was to you, does he have any obligation to make a response when this document is referenced by the court, your answer would be no.
No, he does not, Your Honor.
Just as a follow-up, does the record here, if you know, affirmatively show that the defendant read and discussed the form with the counsel and understood each of the rights waived? That was the test in Hoppe that you referred to, State versus Hoppe.
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yes, the test in Hoppe is whether the record affirmatively shows that the defendant read and discussed the form with counsel and understood each right waived. That's part of the test also. Still requires a personal colloquy. But what does the record show?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to indicate that. Taking Mr. Romero's allegations together, we know that Mr. Romero was unaware of the deportation consequences of this plea before he pled, that those consequences were important enough to him that he would not have pled no contest if he had understood them, and that he is unhappy with his post-conviction counsel's failure to pursue plea withdrawal on his behalf. Put another way, we know what Mr. Romero was claiming in this case, that his post-conviction counsel performed deficiently by failing to raise a strong claim for plea withdrawal that he wished to pursue, and that her performance prejudiced him by denying him the opportunity to withdraw his plea.
Counselor, wouldn't he? So he wants to withdraw his plea and go to trial. I didn't see anything in the briefing about what kind of a defense he was going to raise.
He stated that he would have, that he would not have pled and that instead he would have gone to trial if he had understood. At this point, he's asking to withdraw his plea. If he withdraws his plea, he obviously has two options. He can go to trial or he can enter into some sort of new agreement. The briefing does not address what his defense might be if he goes to trial, and I don't think that it needs to at this point.
Thank you. Well, what he says if he wants to go to trial is the state has the burden of proving his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So he doesn't have to show a defense, does he, until trial?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And he doesn't even have to show a trial because he can just argue the state didn't prove it.
Absolutely, and there are good strategic reasons not to lay out what his defense might be at that point.
Counsel, housekeeping is not my forte, but I want to start with a little housekeeping here, and that is, what are the issues? There seems to be a bit of tension regarding the briefs as to what is the issue. As I understand it, the petition for review, there were three issues set forth. I understand from your footnote one in your brief that you have withdrawn what would be the third issue because of the Padilla and Chavez case. I forget the name of it. So does that leave you with the remaining two issues in your brief, the remaining two issues set forth in your petition for review, or is there a single issue?
Your Honor, I think based on the full briefing in this court, there's really only one issue remaining in this case, and that's whether he's adequately alleged that Mr. Romero has adequately alleged that his post-conviction counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this plea withdrawal claim on his behalf.
Okay. Let me, if I may, pull your brief. And you have17 pages on what I thought was the first issue, because you say this is it. Number one, Romero Jorjana's motion alleges facts that, if true, show that he's entitled to relief on his claim for plea withdrawal under WISSTAT 971-082. And then, so that's one issue. And the next issue starts on 18, that his motion alleges facts that, if true, show that he's entitled to a hearing on his ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. So I interpreted your briefing when I put it together with the petition for review as two issues. Number one, did the defendant's motion for post-conviction relief allege facts which, if true, entitled him to plea withdrawal under 971-082? Got that right from your brief in the first 17 pages. And number two, was the circuit court required to hold an evidentiary hearing on the defendant's motion for post-conviction relief due to ineffective assistance of counsel? Help me. Are those the two issues? Are they not?
Your Honor, I see what you're asking. What I was referring to is that there are two issues that I laid out. I believe that the first issue that I laid out, whether he alleged sufficient facts to show he's entitled to relief under 971-08 sub 2, can be viewed also as a sub-issue of whether he's shown prejudice in his ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim. And what I meant when I said that we're down to one issue in dispute is that the state didn't argue that he didn't adequately allege that he was entitled to relief under 971-08 sub 2. So at this point, I think the only issue in dispute is whether he's adequately alleged his ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim.
And just for my clarification, so you're suggesting that the state is not contesting what would be tantamount to the first 17 pages of your brief? That's what covers that first issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Even on the Negrette issue?
I'm sorry?
Even on the Negrette deportation issue?
The Court of Appeals, the state did argue the Negrette issue, but in the brief before this court, the state did not re-argue that.
Okay. The reason you're arguing ineffective assistance of counsel is because you have to have that to get around Escalona, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, because of all the proceedings that have occurred prior to where we are today.
Yes, Your Honor. The only argued reason for denying Mr. Romero a hearing in this case is his failure to make affirmative allegations refuting a possible strategic reason that could come up at a Mockner hearing to deny him relief. Presumably, that's the possibility that his attorney might testify that they discussed the possibility of plea withdrawal and chose to pursue resentencing instead for strategic reasons. But putting ourselves in the shoes of Mr. Romero, a pro se defendant, if we are Mr. Romero and if no such conversation took place, how do we anticipate the possibility of that testimony and know to allege that it didn't happen? We put attorneys in charge of strategic decisions in furtherance of their clients' goals for a reason. Clients without a legal education are poorly situated to come up with sound legal strategy on their own. Similarly, pro se defendants are poorly situated to come up with and refute the various legal strategies you or I, as legal professionals, might imagine could come up at a Mockner hearing. Again, putting ourselves in Mr. Romero's shoes, a requirement that he allege the absence of a strategic reason for his counsel's failure to raise plea withdrawal presents a significant hurdle to getting a Mockner hearing. That hurdle matters, because defendants no longer have a right to counsel once they have exhausted their direct appeal rights. So the first time many defendants are able to challenge post-conviction counsel's performance, they are likely to be on their own to do so. That type of hurdle is also unnecessary, and this case illustrates why. Based on the allegations in Mr. Romero's motion, there is no question as to what he is claiming or what the purpose of a Mockner hearing would be. Mr. Romero's motion speaks for itself on the point that post-conviction counsel was ineffective for failing to raise a strong claim for plea withdrawal that he wished to pursue. In addition, the purpose of the hearing is clear: to prove, via post-conviction counsel's testimony, that no strategic reason existed for that failure. A Mockner hearing would therefore revolve around post-conviction counsel's stated reasons for failing to make that claim. Because Mr. Romero's motion is clear as to what he is claiming, a hearing to obtain post-conviction counsel's testimony in this case is not a fishing expedition. It is merely a required step toward proving the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that Mr. Romero has laid out in his motion. Instead of raising a claim for plea withdrawal, Mr. Romero's post-conviction counsel raised a claim for resentencing. When deciding against Mr. Romero, the Court of Appeals relied on case law emphasizing the importance of deferring to post-conviction or appellate counsel's choice of issues as a reasonable strategic decision. But that reasoning doesn't apply to Mr. Romero's case, because the choice was not just between issues. It was between different remedies, different possible outcomes. It is universally recognized that while attorneys are in charge of many strategic decisions on behalf of their clients, it is clients who must decide the goals of representation. We recognize that in Wisconsin in our professional rules. Supreme Court Rule 20.1.2a states that a lawyer shall abide by a client's decision concerning the objectives of representation.
Counselor, but if in fact counsel sat down and said, you know, we can ask for a resentencing here and you might well get something less, or we can ask to withdraw your plea, but then you got to go to trial, and if you're convicted, you're going to be in the same position that you're in now and maybe get a greater sentence. And the defendant says, no, I want to have a plea withdrawal. And the lawyer says, all right, that's your choice, you do it. We'd be here again. He'd say he's not equipped to make that choice, and certainly he would be right. That's why we have counsel, as you earlier said in your argument. So I thought your brief was actually wonderfully well done, and I thought the argument was very creative. But I would hate to put the defendant in the position of making what is a legal choice rather than a factual choice.
Your Honor, I think that the attorney's role in a case like this is to set out what the pros and cons of these different outcomes might be.
But there are so many unknowns, Counselor. I mean, if he seeks plea withdrawal and he's convicted of the crime of which he's charged, he's not going to be in any different position and could certainly have gotten a longer sentence. It was counselor's advice that he might get a lesser sentence if he went, and that seemed to please him then. I think it displeased him because he didn't get a lesser sentence but got a greater sentence. So, you know, to say that the defendant should make this choice, I think puts a defendant in a very vulnerable position. I don't think that defendants in criminal trials should be forced to make this kind of a decision. I think it's a decision that sometimes a lawyer makes on behalf of a client. And Attorney Hagopian is before us all the time. She is a very skilled lawyer. She's not someone that's done one or two criminal cases.
Your Honor, I think it's important here to note that at the trial level, for example, we do say that it's absolutely always the defendant's choice whether to go to trial or whether to plead.
It's a different question. It has very different ramifications.
It is a different question, but the balance is very similar in that there may be cases where an attorney truly believes that his or her client will not benefit from going to trial for any number of reasons and might actually be hurt by it. And the client's role in that sort of case is to explain to the client, the attorney's role, I'm sorry, is to explain to the client what the risks are. And then it's the client's decision what risks he or she wants to take. And that's the way it should be in a case like this, too. You lay out what the risks are, if you're the attorney.
Presumably, counselor, these risks were already laid out when a plea was given. Okay, so he decided not to go to trial once already. That's what a plea's all about. And now you're saying on a motion down the road, many steps down the road, he should have been able to decide whether or not resentencing might give him a better break than withdrawing his plea and going to trial. Well, you're redoing what he's already decided to do the first time, and you're balancing it against something else, which is, will the sentence be less? Apparently, he was willing to accept a lesser sentence, or they wouldn't have gone forward on the argument here for resentencing. I mean, he was involved in his case all the way through. He's never alleged that he wasn't involved in this case. Now he's saying he would have made the other choice. I get that, and I understand why, and I don't fault him for making the choice here. My concern is with your argument that at this point, an attorney must let the client make the choice when the attorney advised otherwise. Now, if the client would stand up and say, no, I don't want to do this, I guess the attorney always accedes to that. But what I got from your brief is that this is a choice for a client to make, not a choice for an attorney to make. And I find difficulty with that. I don't think they're prepared to weigh the legal obstacles at this point.
Your Honor, yes, I am arguing that it would be the client's choice to make.
His first choice. He already made a choice. I'm not going to go to trial. I'm going to plead. What about that choice?
He did, but he wasn't fully informed when he made that decision. And he has a right to plea withdrawal under 971.08 sub 2. And when he has the right to withdraw his plea and start over if he wants to, that's a very, very different outcome or goal than resentencing.
It's a different goal if he's not convicted. If he's convicted, it's no different. He still is going to get deported.
But it's his choice whether he wants to take that risk and have that opportunity again. Yes, the risks are greater, but so are the opportunities in a case like that.
I ask, we're talking about options here. Is it possible that both of those options could have been pursued?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It is.
How would that have worked?
If the counsel could have, for example, made a first we would like this, and if that doesn't work, we would like this sort of motion. They could have put the resentencing claim first and in the alternative plea withdrawal, or vice versa.
Is there, if someone withdraws the plea, that doesn't preclude a new plea, does it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor.
Is there any plea that he could have made that would have not subjected him to potential deportation?
Your Honor, I am not an expert on immigration law, but certainly negotiations are sometimes made to reduce the charge so that it wouldn't be classified as an aggravated felony requiring deportation. And that does happen in some cases.
As a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question, There was reference in the briefs to the clearly stronger standard. And how, if at all, does the clearly stronger standard recently set forth in Starks affect your argument or your defendant's case?
Well, Your Honor, if the clearly stronger standard is applied as a threshold requirement, this case is a good example of the difficulties of using that, because since he did, in fact, get a resentencing hearing based on counsel's motion, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to show that any claim is clearly stronger. But in this case, we have another claim that he would have been entitled to relief and different relief on. And therefore, the clearly stronger standard just doesn't seem to work as a framework for analyzing his and counsel's decision in this case.
Your argument is premised, then, on the clearly stronger being applied in a fact situation where the facts of the case, the transcript would demonstrate no personal advice by the judge regarding deportation warnings, and also the record would reflect the status of deportation proceedings in some way. If the record was not so clear, conceivably there would be could clearly stronger then apply, or does clearly stronger not apply in a case involving 971-082?
My argument would be more as to whether the remedy is the same or different. And if the strength of the second claim was more in dispute, there's more room to argue that clearly stronger matters. However, my position is still that it's the client's choice to decide which remedies to pursue.
Position, isn't it, that Attorney Hagopian never discussed any options in the post-judgment phase, right?
My position is that Mr. Romero's motion clearly lays out that one of two things happened, that he wanted plea withdrawal, and that means that one of two things happened. Your Honor, I have a red light. May I finish?
Respond to the question, counsel.
And that means that one of two things happened. Either Attorney Hagopian did not see, notice, or discuss plea withdrawal as an option, plea withdrawal under 971-08 sub 2 as an option, or she did, and he wanted to pursue it, and she didn't, and she failed to do that and pursued resentencing.
Well, I think there's a third choice, in that she discussed it with him, and he said to her, what do you think? And she said, I think it's a better choice to try for resentencing, and he said, fine. I mean, that's also an option.
That is a possibility, but his allegation that he didn't understand the deportation consequences of his plea, and that he would not have pled if he had, indicate that he was interested in plea withdrawal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. William L. Gansner, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
Good morning.
All life involves choice. I suspect when the United States Supreme Court announced the decision in Strickland versus Washington 30 years ago, they believed that they were resolving a thorny issue in the federal and state courts, and that they had provided a solution for dealing with difficult questions. The 30 years since then have revealed the creation of an entirely new industry of thorns and difficulties. We're faced today with a novel situation in which in the post-conviction motion context, an experienced attorney is challenged for the decision she made to pursue a meritorious claim. The choice that was before Suzanne Hagopian, if we are to presume, as I believe we must, under Strickland and this court's precedents, that counsel is presumed to have acted reasonably, is that defense counsel realized the possibility of, I think under the best of circumstances, we are entitled to presume, I'm going to make an argument in a moment that will put a gloss on that of a slightly different nature, but we're entitled to presume that defense counsel, experienced defense counsel, exercised a judgment to choose between two possible remedies. Justice Prosser asked whether it was possible for defense counsel to have moved both to withdraw the plea and for resentencing. And surely the filing of a motion phrased in the alternative was certainly possible. It is interesting to note, however, that had counsel done so, we might very well be faced with a claim that I believe the defendant is now making that, well, it wasn't his choice then which of those two remedies might possibly be granted. By moving in the alternative, in essence, counsel gave the circuit court or a higher court the choice of which alternative
to
grant.
Whose choice
is
it?
I don't think both can be granted.
Mr. Gansner, in this case, whose choice is it to decide whether to withdraw the plea or just ask for resentencing? We've had cases where the defendant asks for resentencing. Comes up here and the court says, hey, you could have asked for a withdrawal of the plea. And defense counsel says, yes, but the defendant didn't want to do that. Only wants resentencing. And in those cases, that was the remedy that the court looked at. So, whose choice is it? Now, we know that there are a whole number of choices that the attorney makes, right? Procedural. And then there are a number of choices that the defendant must make. And for the attorney to take those choices away from the defendant would be ineffective assistance of counsel. So I want to know, now the defendant takes the position here that the choice of whether to have a plea withdrawal or resentencing, was the defendant's, and that on this record, the allegation is, I didn't make that choice, and that's ineffective assistance of counsel. Had I been given the choice, I would have asked for a plea withdrawal, and that matters to me because of deportation, right? So, I've read your brief, and it seems to me that you think this was the defense counsel's choice, not the defendant's. Is that your position?
Our position is this. Without question, the initial determination of how a defendant should respond to a criminal charge, the initial decision of how to plead in response to a charge, must rest with the defendant. Once an advised and presumably voluntary decision to enter a plea has been entered, however, and we move into the realm of whether there are possible remedies to cure problems that occurred prior to conviction, for instance, defects in the actual taking of the plea, while without question it is the height of responsibility, of professional responsibility for counsel to advise the defendant on the choices and the alternatives that are available, the state is reluctant to say that the absolutely controlling voice under these circumstances, exclusive of advice from counsel, is the defendant's. The initial entry choice of a plea to enter, yes. But frankly, I don't think this really comes down to a question of whose choice it was whether to withdraw the plea or move for resentencing. We don't have, in this case, enough facts about what really happened in this case. And on that matter, I believe Ms. Braley is right. We agree that the determinative question in this case is whether or not the defendant in his post-conviction motion alleged sufficient facts that, if proven, would demonstrate both deficient performance by counsel and prejudice by the defendant.
For deficient performance by counsel, an avenue, of course, if there has been a sufficient showing in the motion, is a Mockner hearing,
yeah.
Right? And so I find it quite disconcerting that we are here many, many years after these proceedings have taken place and trying to assess, was it counsel strategy? What, if any, input did the defendant have into the decision? Let's figure this out. That's no way to run a whatever you run, it sounds to me. I mean, we've heard in this oral argument questions about what really went on. Well, isn't that the reason you have a Mockner hearing? And if you, in a Mockner hearing, determine based on the evidence presented, there's no deficient performance, end of story.
We are.
I say counsel.
Right. We are years down the line, and it's a perfectly valid question to ask, why are we still here after all of this time? Let me suggest one reasonable answer to that. Rather than years of debate over the sufficiency of allegations or insufficiency of allegations in a complaint, the difficulty and the insufficiencies that we believe, the gaps, the ambiguity, the lack of information that's in the motion in this case, could have been solved years ago by a simple telephone call. Attorney Hagopian, why did you make the choice that you did? That needs to be in the motion. I think the precedent from this court is perfectly clear that before we proceed to a Mockner hearing, a defendant is required to allege facts which, if proven at the Mockner hearing, would establish his or her entitlement to relief.
Boy,
there are no facts alleged in this motion as to why Attorney Hagopian made the apparent decision that she did. And we know that is a burden on the defendant to demonstrate that the choice that was made was an unreasonable one.
Let's take a look. I guess I'm going to step back. What framework do we use in this case? Do we use a la Bangert, or do we use an a la Bentley to determine the sufficiency of the averments in the motion and attached affidavit? If we use the Bangert framework, what you're suggesting to me is a major departure from our jurisprudence, that we would now have to make we now have to call counsel and get from counsel, what was your strategy before you even get a Mockner hearing? I say, I'm not sure. You know, it's a Monday morning. I'm not sure. I'm ready to make that big of a step in our jurisprudence. What's your response? Not about my Monday morning, but that it's a huge departure from our existing jurisprudence on Bangert and what you need to get a Mockner hearing.
I don't think it would be, Your Honor, in this case, for the simple reason that, as the defendant concedes, the only way he can proceed on a claim that the plea colloquy in this case was defective, that there was not a compliance with the statutory mandate to inform the defendant about the possible deportation consequences, is for the defendant to show that his counsel was ineffective in failing to make it. Why? Because this isn't a Bangert-type situation. We are not in the post-conviction circumstances of an individual who has the last act in the case was the pleading, the entry of a plea, and conviction. And then the defendant says, wait a minute, there was a defect in the plea proceedings. We have here instead a defendant who pled, was sentenced, brought a post-conviction motion, succeeded on it, took an appeal, succeeded there, and we are in the Escalona world. As the defendant concedes, the defendant can pursue this claim of a defect in the plea colloquy only if he can prove that there was a sufficient reason why he didn't raise the claim earlier. That's what distinguishes this case from the Bangert situation. So my answer to the question is, and I believe it's defendant's answer would be also, we're in a Bentley situation. We're not in a Bangert situation. The allegation of plea colloquy deficiency is one that the circuit court could reach only after a determination that there was a sufficient reason why the issue hadn't been raised in the first place.
Under our case law, sufficient yes. reason is ineffective assistance of counsel, so that gets us back to
that's the hook that's used to get right. into the door of the courthouse.
I have before me the transcript of the plea hearing. I don't know if you have had an opportunity to look at it recently. Maybe not. Maybe yes.
Oh, this morning I did.
Okay, that's pretty recent then. Then I'll feel a little more at liberty to ask you about it. There's nothing in here that mentions the word or comes close to the whole deportation immigration stuff.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. And sometimes you find in plea hearings a little bit more about the plea questionnaire. I guess I found this plea hearing to be pretty sparse. On page 2, there is a reference to the plea questionnaire, and it says, the court's been presented with a plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form.
Mm-hmm.
The plea questionnaire indicates, I'm jumping a bit, that you're the plea questionnaire indicates that you're prepared to enter a plea of no contest to first-degree sexual assault of a child under 13 years of age. So that's one reference to the plea questionnaire. And there's two references on page 3. One reference is, there's an attachment to the plea questionnaire which outlines in a criminal jury instruction the element of the offense. And at the bottom of page 3, there's also a reference and you went through this form, and as you went through the Spanish form, which is also attached, and before you signed it, did you recognize that you were waiving or giving up basic constitutional rights?
Is the state's position that this plea comports with the statutory mandate set forth in 971-082?
We've acknowledged in our brief that this was not compliance with the statutory mandate. This court has been clear on a number of occasions that the statute requires a specific instruction by the court to a defendant. It's perfectly clear from this record that that was not done here. This is not a case where I believe we can look to some fairly strong evidences that words similar to that required by the statute or the required by this court's decision were used, or that the evidence was so strong, other extrinsic evidence was so strong that the information had been communicated to the defendant that that we would be saying, wait a minute, the failure to give the admonition in the specific words of this court's decisions and the statute was harmless. But this court, I think, has made clear that that's really not subject to harmless error. In this case, we could see there was not, it's perfectly clear the plea didn't. But may I point out, the plea colloquy did not involve the statutory instruction. But if I can, on page 4, and this is going to jump a little bit, but I'm taking the opportunity of your looking closely at the plea transcript. At page 4, there's something else that appears to be a reference to what might have been in the plea questionnaire, where the judge says, and the only promise that anyone has made to you, Mr. Romero, to plead, is that the state agrees not to file any additional charges and to make no specific recommendation at sentencing. Why do I emphasize that?
Because I know why you emphasize it, but
tell me.
You tell me why you emphasize it.
It was only slightly rhetorical.
I know why.
Because it's because it demonstrates the choice. We know that post-conviction counsel had a choice to make. We presume that an experienced post-conviction counsel had a choice to make, which remedy to pursue. But this defendant had a choice to make as well. And we believe that the allegations of his motion are insufficient because they don't really address the question that leaps off the page of his motion, challenging the effectiveness of post-conviction counsel. We know that you've alleged, had I been told, about the possibility of challenging the absence of a deportation warning, that I would have pursued that remedy. But the question needs to be asked, perhaps rhetorically, but legally and significantly in this case, really? Seriously? Wait, if you had challenged and the colloquy instead of the sentence, you would have been returned to square one, facing the original charge. Any agreement of the state not to file additional charges, which is a common occurrence in child sexual assault cases, especially when the assault takes place within a close semi-familial relationship or family relationship, that's a common practice. And the state would have the defendant would no longer be entitled to the benefit of the state's promise to make no sentencing recommendation. Let's recall there's a 60-year maximum sentence possible, and this defendant had, even when resentenced, received a 50% sub-maximum sentence.
I know the defendant is charged with and has pled to horrendous crimes.
Yes.
I know that he stands to spend a lot of time in prison. I know that's not something that any of us want to be in our neighborhood or sitting next to in a court. I know all of that. The question is, for me, something you talk about. What would a reasonable defendant do? Well, I think 971082 brings us to a little a different world than a lot of defendants experience. If someone is facing deportation and doesn't want to be deported, I can't imagine a defendant not choosing plea withdrawal rather than sentencing. I can't imagine it. Now, you see it differently, but I can't imagine it because what that defendant wants to do is to get the conviction for the qualifying felony off. The defendant and getting a sentencing does nothing to thwart at all, nothing to thwart the deportation. The only thing that's going to thwart the deportation here, given those two choices, is plea withdrawal. Now, that presumes that the defendant wants to thwart deportation. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not knowledgeable about immigration law. The problem is, I think maybe lots of folks aren't, including lawyers involved in criminal law. And you may the record reflect you're pointing to yourself, but I think a lot of people, you know, there's such intricacies in this kind of area of law. But with a broad brush, I can say, my sense is a defendant who wants to thwart deportation absolutely will go for the plea withdrawal, because resentencing does nothing to thwart it. What's your response to that?
Let me add a comment that's on the opposite side of the scales on that. I think the Court of Appeals in this case and the Circuit Court was absolutely correct in saying and assuming from the standpoint of, I mean, and again, I realize we're talking about a defendant who may have a particular, very significant, and personally inspired set of goals, and defense counsel, whose professional job it is to do the best job possible representing the defendant's interests. But, and those may diverge. But I think the Court of Appeals and Circuit Court were both correct in saying that it was an entirely reasonable strategy for a defense attorney, a post-conviction counsel, faced with a sentence that was imposed in violation of then-existing guidelines, to make the decision to choose to challenge the sentence in hopes that, if successful, as the defense counsel was, the case could be returned for resentencing with the possibility of a lesser sentence being imposed. But we know what happened in this case. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen.
No, but deportation would have been a consequence of that choice.
But deportation could have been the consequence, the highly likely consequence, I think any post-conviction counsel would have advised client, any trial counsel would have advised client, that if we withdraw your guilty plea and we go back to square one, you still face prosecution. You may go, if you're going to insist on going to a trial, if that's the choice that you are, constitutional choice that you are electing to make, the consequence at the end of that process may be the reinstatement of a conviction, and you're going to be in the exact same situation you are right now, convicted of a deportable offense. Now, for what it's worth, and I can't put myself in the situation of an attorney well-versed in deportation law or the interface between federal immigration law and state criminal law, because I haven't practiced in that area. But we know that now, years after this conviction, this defendant is still in the United States. He's still serving his sentence in a state prison. He has not been deported, despite the fact that he's been under a deportation order now for numerous years. I don't know how the process works. It may be that he remains here until some substantial portion or all of his sentence is served before leaving. If his goal was to avoid deportation for any of a constellation of reasons, he hasn't been deported. He has been imprisoned, but those were among and apparently were the two most likely consequences of the choices that this defendant had. I think this is a situation in which it was entirely reasonable for the Court of Appeals to conclude and for this court to conclude that a determination by Suzanne Hagopian that it was in the defendant's interests, I'm not going to use the word best interest here because I want to make a comment about the clearly stronger standard. It was in the defendant's interests to pursue what she had good reason to believe was a winning strategy to attack the sentence. Unfortunately, after a new judge was brought in, the hope that a lesser sentence might get imposed proved wrong. But that was a reasonable choice. On the face of it, the allegations that this defendant has made in his motion are not sufficient to push us past or even to put a chip into the starting presumption required by Strickland versus Washington that counsel are presumed to act in the exercise of reasonable professional judgment. It was a reasonable professional judgment to make the choice that she did.
We also don't know a lot of things. I mean, I asked a little bit about a defense, and obviously this is not the place where you put up a defense, but this was sexual assault of a 6-year-old child, which is not going to be looked upon favorably if there is a conviction after and sentencing comes about. And we have experienced counsel who makes a choice to try to get his sentence reduced. And in order to prove ineffective assistance to counsel, we have to say that that choice was deficient performance, correct? I mean, I think it's very difficult to shoulder that burden
yes.
without showing why the other choice would have been to his advantage. And I just...
Your Honor, I think that, frankly, something extraordinary would have to be proven up at a Mockner hearing for us to conclude that an unreasonable, unprofessional judgment was made by counsel in this case. We don't know precisely why. We don't know exactly why Suzanne Hagopian made the choice she did, because apparently nobody's asked her. And I'm suggesting that rather than spend years litigating, this court should say clearly to counsel, whether they are challenging the effectiveness of trial counsel or post-conviction counsel or appellate counsel, when you are challenging a decision made by counsel, you need to address in your motion why there is reason to believe the choice that counsel made was unreasonable. We don't know. One of the most basic facts, long ago, in an opinion drafted by a member of this court, in a concurring opinion, I believe, it was said the first thing that has to be determined in an ineffective assistance of counsel case is what happened and why. That's been reduced to the W's and H's rule, the rule of pleading. We don't know why Suzanne Hagopian made the choice that she did, and there ought to be an allegation, especially in a case like this, that suggests that there's any improper reason or unreasonable reason why the choice was made. If I could
that
just
means that a person in prison has to get to the phone or get to counsel and do that, right?
By a letter or phone or telegraph or
right.
Pony Express, you bet.
Well,
this defendant
you know, it's hard enough to use snail mail from prison. We don't have to go to the Pony Express. I don't think they allow horses.
Right.
So,
sorry to bring up horses.
Who drafted this form that's used in Brown County on the motion for post-conviction relief? Do we know that?
Do I know what?
Who drafted this form
that was used as the motion in this case?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the origin of that is. I don't know if that's something that the Brown County Circuit Court has developed or not. I don't know.
Well, I don't think so because Brown is typed in. So, because we've seen some forms that have been proposed by the Department of Justice, and I just wondered if this one is
I wasn't involved in its authorship or if it came out of our office. I do not know. Frankly, I think the work of all of the courts of this state would be significantly assisted if there was some standardization in motion practice in the forms that are made available principally to pro se litigants.
Yeah, which this person was. Yeah. The other thing is, it seems to me, one, you're not willing to go as far as I was trying to get the state to go. You're not willing to say that at all times, under all circumstances, it's counsel's choice after the plea as to whether motions should be made for withdrawing plea or resentencing. You're not willing to go that far.
I'm not because I don't think...
I agree with you.
Yeah. I don't think it's a clear-cut choice. I think it's too complicated an issue.
That's right.
The relationship between client and attorney
right.
is too sensitive and complicated for that to be subject to a black-and-white rule in all cases.
That's right. And you'd have to know what counsel said to the defendant and what the defendant said to counsel before you could decide that. But you probably would agree that defense counsel was ineffective or was below the reasonable standard if an explanation was not made that under the case law and statute, a withdrawal of plea was possible because of the bad colloquy.
I think that would be highly questionable conduct. Absolutely. I mean,
if that was not done. Absolutely. Right.
Right.
And he is, in effect, saying that here. And you don't think that's good enough?
Well, if the best I can say is that this defendant is, in effect, saying that, then I'm suggesting that the defendant ought to speak more clearly. We don't know At most, because this motion is prepared by the defendant, we know what he's saying about himself. I'm not going to assail his allegations as being self-serving. Of course, every defendant's statements and motion allegations in
support of an effort
would be self-serving. But we don't have any allegations about what his counsel did, and that's the important question in one half of the Strickland
test. He says Romero contends he would not have entered a plea of no contest had he fully understood he would have been deported. He says...
not to quibble, Your Honor, but there's a little bit of an adverbial wiggle room there that he was fully informed. It sounds like lawyer talk to me.
So does your brief.
He's a lawyer.
Oh, no.
I'm tempted to say bada bing.
Okay, and he goes on to say that he didn't understand, et cetera.
Okay.
And you're supposed to read these documents liberally and helping out a pro se,
sure.
But not going so far as to put in a whole lot of words, right?
Right. Yes.
Then I thought I'd get to your brief. And the kicker for me was on page, let's see.
Your Honor?
Yeah.
I don't think that's my brief.
The red brief.
I'm sorry, the red brief. The kicker, and it's open to the right.
Willing to take responsibility for my words.
Okay, page 7. It's open to it. And it starts at page 6. Thus, this case turns upon the answer to a relatively narrow question, bottom of 6. Whether Romero's motion alleged sufficient facts, which if proved in an evidentiary hearing, would establish ineffective of initial post-conviction counsel and thereby provide a sufficient reason to overcome Escalona's bar to the motion and permit him to proceed. And you take the position that the only way to overcome the Escalona bar, which is you can't have repeated motions, put all the stuff in one motion, and Escalona says you can have repeated motions if you have a good cause, reason, right?
Right.
But the only good reason is not ineffective assistance of counsel, is it?
No, there are other reasons. And okay. I don't think the defendant has suggested some other reason. And the reason I phrased that issue in the fashion that I did is I believe that is the one issue that remains in this case, and I believe that's a statement of the issue that the defense would agree with. I mean, they acknowledge that they must prove a sufficient reason to overcome Escalona's bar to the assertion of the claim, and they've suggested that that reason that they're asserting in this case is ineffectiveness.
Well, it seems to me that, and when I started to read this, that it flies off the pages of this transcript, and it flies off the facts of this case, that the plea colloquy on deportation was bad, just bad, and that left at that stage a withdrawal of plea is required by the statute. If you ask for it, it's required.
Right.
And that counsel who would not have made that allegation and would not have made a motion on that seems to me to raise a presumption that there was a problem with counsel. So it seems to me that we have a statute that says if the court doesn't do it, you get a new agreement, a new plea, that you've got a situation on its face which is stronger than a resentencing, on its face.
I believe we have a clear record that demonstrates that there was an available claim for challenging the plea. We also have, because this case comes out of the real world, a defense attorney and a defendant who needed to make a choice of how to proceed.
Ah, you now get the statute both had does, to make
the statute
choice.
Does not mandate withdrawal of a plea
Absolutely.
Without the choice of a defendant to seek that remedy.
That's right.
This defendant, through his counsel, did not seek that remedy.
Well, we don't know that. That's the problem.
Well, we know that the remedy wasn't sought.
That's
Why
right.
the remedy was not sought is what That's we right. don't know.
And would know with a Mottner hearing.
Exactly.
Okay. If at a Mottner hearing proof was offered that there was no good reason, proof was offered to show that counsel, the presumption of counsel's reasonable conduct is overcome. That's what we submit is a pleading requirement under this court's precedent. And we merely ask that this court enforce that precedent and resolve this case in that manner.
No, we seem to be having, which is not all your fault, a number of cases where the court, where somebody comes up here, either plaintiff or defendant, civil or criminal, and says, this is just a pleading matter. Just a pleading matter. The whole concept of civil practice with new pleading agreements and new pleading rules is you don't throw someone out of court for pleading. You don't go back to the common law doctrine. You didn't plead it right, you're out of here. You go back to a common sense kind of view of pleading, and is it just good enough to get you to a hearing? So I'm quite, we keep getting these cases just on pleading.
I understand that argument. And my only
one you're making today.
Excuse me?
It's not one you're making today.
It is not. No, I can understand an argument without making it. No, it is not. Because my view is that under this court's precedent and under the United States Supreme Court's decision in Strickland, a defendant seeking to challenge a conviction or conduct of counsel on grounds of ineffectiveness must allege and then prove at an evidentiary hearing facts that establish that counsel acted unreasonably. No such conduct, that was not alleged in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel? Defense counsel?
Counsel, can I ask, why wasn't the strategy used here the best possible strategy for this defendant in that try to get resentencing, and if you don't get a better sentence, then try for plea withdrawal and then go to the allegation of the failure to give the deportation warning?
Your Honor, if we presume, and I think it would be a presumption, that the client's goal was to achieve a lower sentence, it may well be that that was the best strategy. However, there's more at stake here than that, as there is in any case where a client has a choice between plea withdrawal and sentencing. Plea withdrawal actually removes the conviction. And in this case, that had what the defendant has alleged were very important immigration consequences to him. So I think we're importing a goal of a lesser sentence on the client when we do that.
Counselor, did the University of Wisconsin prepare the forms through the Innocence Project or some other projects that are used in this matter?
I believe that it may have been one of the clinics at the University of Wisconsin that prepared that form, but I'm not 100% certain on that.
Thank you.
I want to start by re-emphasizing the wide body of law that says that the client is the person to make this decision about what the goal of representation might be. And as I just mentioned, in this case, there's more at stake than just what his sentence is. There's the deportation consequences and his conviction as a whole. I think this can be analogized to other situations, such as the healthcare setting, where a doctor is the best medical expert in the room, but the patient still gets to decide what the treatment is, even if the doctor, as an expert, believes that the patient's decision puts their life at risk. The doctor's job is...
Can I ask you one other question that's kind of... It's a practical question. What would you have had counsel do here, other than a Mockmeyer hearing? What proactive steps would defense counsel take to make sure they don't end up in a situation where someone's claiming this?
I think what counsel needed to do in this case is explain to the defendant what the options were.
But how do you make a record of that? That's my question. Should you call up the court and say, I'd like to go back on the record here and have a court record of what we've done? Because then you're sort of invading that, the province of attorney-client privilege and those kinds of... What would you have counsel do so that defense counsel is protected and they don't end up with this sort of Monday morning quarterbacking or second-guessing or, you didn't tell me this, you didn't tell me this? I'm just trying to think as a practical matter, how do you head this off at the pass so that we don't end up with these issues? What's the answer?
I think that it would be somewhat inappropriate to make a record of what those discussions were. However, if counsel has the discussions with the client as to what the options are, what the pros and cons of those options are, we can at least hope and expect that a motion like this won't happen. Because in this case, the defendant has alleged that this was important enough to him and that he did want to pursue plea withdrawal.
But that to me seems like we're always going to have a hearing. I mean, all you have to do is, if you don't, I mean, let's just assume he wanted a resentencing and hoping for a lesser sentence, which is not uncommon. But then you don't get that. Then you think, okay, what else can I go for? I mean, you're always putting defense counsel in the seat of defending themselves sort of after the fact. You're just hoping this motion won't come, really.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the expectation when defendants file this motion is that they're going to tell the truth in it. And so it's the expectation then would be, and we do take their allegations, they have to allege sufficient facts that, if true, show that they're entitled to relief. And the idea is that when they make those allegations, they're going to tell the truth. And there's in this case, if that were the case, I don't think we'd have the motion that we have today.
Okay. Counsel, why does this fall under 97406? I have before me something I'm not going to totally share with you, which is an unpublished decision from 2006 from the Court of Appeals. And the facts are somewhat similar to the case here. A fellow named Xiong, X-I-O-N-G, pled guilty in 202, 204. He files a 97406 motion to withdraw his plea because of deportation. And ultimately, the court says, and it's pro se, that's important because the court talks about the need to liberally construe pro se pleadings. And it says in the penultimate paragraph, we decline to adopt the state's hyper-technical view of Xiong's motion. Although labeled a 97406 motion, Xiong's motion nonetheless requested plea withdrawal. It was a case also where it was clear that the deportation warnings were not given. We liberally construe Xiong's pro se motion as a 97108-2 motion for plea withdrawal, based on the court's failure to personally inform him of the deportation consequences of his plea. So my question is, why does 97108(2) have to be a 97406 motion at all? This court said, hey, we're going to liberally construe. I know it's labeled a 97406. It's on the money with regard to 97108(2), and we're just going to look at the statutory elements of 97108(2) and they're met. Why?
Your Honor, I see that my time is up, but if I may.
You may respond.
I believe that it could have been raised as a straight 97108(2) motion. As this court knows, we were appointed at the point of, after the petition for review was filed and the case had been decided up to that point under 97406. And we believe that our client is entitled to relief on that basis. And so that's how we've construed the motion and argued it, and I think he should win.
Well, but you made the same argument that Justice Bradley has just proposed to you on pages 8 to 17 of your brief, but then you seem to have withdrawn that. That's what's so puzzling to us. I should say me. Because it seems to me you got persuaded by the state's brief at page 7 that I read to you from Escalona. And Escalona does not say that the only way you can get around Escalona is by ineffective assistance of counsel. It says, you got any reasonable grounds to say why you didn't do it, you're in the ballpark again. And so it seems to me that you can say, hey, counsel selected this. I didn't talk to her about it. She didn't tell me. I didn't understand. Had I done all of that, I would have selected plea withdrawal because I'm facing deportation. And yet, because this wasn't explained to me by the judge, it wasn't explained to me by counsel, I want a Machner hearing, at which point I will prove or try to prove, and maybe I can't prove, that I'm entitled to a plea withdrawal under 971. But you didn't take that position.
Through Your Honor, we did not. We took the case as it came to us. This court's order granting review specifically asked us to stay within the arguments made in the petition for review, and that did not include an argument that this case should be decided as a 97108 sub 2 motion by itself. Again, we believe that our client is entitled to relief, to a Machner hearing, which is what he's been denied by the trial court at this point, and that is what we're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both defense counsel and state counsel for their arguments today in yet another case involving why the circuit court should not grant a Machner hearing and the sufficiency of allegations. This concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 55, State versus Andres Romero Gorgana. And I will have a recess of a few minutes for those students who wished to leave. We are in recess.